It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can find all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends. Today, I have a conversation for you with Byron York. He's the chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. He's someone who has covered the Afghan conflict from the domestic political perspective in America over the course of the past 2 decades. And so he's the perfect person to talk to about the way that this war and its supporters have been dealing with the ramifications of President Biden's withdrawal approach and everything that's been going on in Afghanistan that has taken over the airwaves in recent days. Byron York, again, is chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. You can also sign up for his newsletter, his daily memo at WashingtonExaminer.com. Byron York, right after this.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Byron, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I want to talk to you about Afghanistan, obviously, but I wanted to start just by crediting you for what I thought was a very important point that you made in your Friday daily memo, which people can subscribe to at WashingtonExaminer.com, about Afghanistan, which kind of did a really good recap of a number of the different decisions that were made in the early 2000s during the Bush years and the like that have to be included in any conversation about what's going on there today. As someone who covered this politically, domestically here in America from the beginning, what do you think some of the major events are that we've forgotten about by this point that really led us to the terrible circumstances that we're all witnessing today?
Well, the first thing you have to remember is that Afghanistan in 2001 was a necessary war. The 9/11 attacks had been planned in Afghanistan, had been all the operational things, all of that had been planned by Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. There was about 90% popular support for going to war in Afghanistan. I was certainly in that 90% that favored going to war in Afghanistan.
Sure. And as was I should say, yes.
And if you go back, Donald Rumsfeld, who was then the Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration and had been Secretary of Defense years earlier, had this idea that the United States could kind of go to war in a light sort of way, be like sort of lightning fast, lethal, and get in, get out, do the job quickly, as opposed to, for example, what had happened in the first Gulf War when George H.W. Bush went to war. And we did it kind of the traditional way, with ships taking lots and lots of materiel across the ocean to Iraq, and not just, you know, in and out with the transport planes. So they sort of did it in this new lightning fast way, this war in Afghanistan. And the fact was, there were a number of people that we didn't get, the biggest, of course, being Osama bin Laden. You go in, Osama bin Laden is well known to be the guiding force in Afghanistan, in Al-Qaeda, and we don't get him. There's a figure named Mullah Omar, who was the head of the Taliban there, who aids and abets the 9/11 planning. We don't get him either. Bin Laden's number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri. We don't get him either. And Zawahiri and Mullah Omar would die deaths of natural causes more than a decade later. And we finally got bin Laden a decade later under President Obama. in 2011. So we don't really accomplish the mission of wiping out everybody who had anything to do with 9/11. But we do a lot of damage to al-Qaeda and its ability to plan any future attacks. Bin Laden is basically reduced to living in a cave without modern communications, which renders him ineffective. So that's good. The problem is, at some point, pretty early on, under George W. Bush, the mission turns into a nation-building mission. Mm-hmm. That there is this belief that to prevent future terrorist attacks, you have to fix the conditions that led to the former terrorist attack that made Afghanistan a haven for terrorism. You have to build schools, build roads, send girls to school, something obviously that the Islamist fundamentalists of the Taliban would never, ever do. Mm-hmm. You have to flood the country with cell phones and modern communications. You have to sort of bring them up into the 21st century. And after a very early point in the war, certainly by 2003, the war is basically a nation-building exercise. So we not only want to kill the bad guys, which we only partially succeed at, we want to turn Afghanistan into a modern, democratic, liberal nation. And that's a recipe for failure. Yeah. And it goes on and on and on and on until the present day.
There's so many different aspects of the decision processes that at the time, looking back on them, seem very well-meaning and incredibly naive. And I know that I have, you know, the luxury of not having been a decision maker, you know, at that point. But it does just strike me as ludicrous in retrospect that this would be an approach adopted by so many people at the heights of power in American government, just given the fractious history of Afghanistan as a nation notable for its lack of control, its lack of ability to be controlled. What was going on at the time that really led them to turn this conflict that had been, you know, of the sold to the American people as delivering, as you say, swift justice to those who had actually come after us on 9/11 and those who had coddled and supported them, into something that was instead supposed to be some type of example to the world of the goodness that America could achieve in a nation building exercise?
Well, you know, what's interesting, this whole idea of Afghanistan being the graveyard of empires, we're hearing that quote resurrected in recent hours. There was a lot of discussion at the time. You know, Bush does not go to war on September 12th. Mm-hmm. The United States planned an exercise. Everybody knew we were going to hit Afghanistan, but it took a couple of months to get ready. And in that time, there was a lot of talk about and use of the word quagmire, that the United States, this is before we even went in, that we might get bogged down in Afghanistan the way the Soviet Union had done. And remember, when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, there were Americans who supported the, you know, the plucky Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets.
Who will always be our friends and allies, just like Saddam Hussein.
You know, it's just, life can be just horribly funny sometimes. And so that was, but there was a lot of talk before we go into Afghanistan that we could get bogged down, which I think is one of the things that encouraged Bush and Rumsfeld to try to do this lightning strike sort of thing, so that we would not, you know, join the graveyard of empires. But also there is this on this nation building idea. First of all, there's always been this kind of a nation building ideal sort of inside American thinking. There were the neoconservatives who were at the time obviously supporting the Afghanistan war, like you and I did, mm-hmm. but also wanting to go to war in Iraq, where they felt that Saddam Hussein could be toppled and a democratic government of some sort installed by the United States. So there was a lot of talk, you know, about democracies don't go to war with each other. There are lots of sort of catchphrases that kind of flew around conservative circles in the Bush years. You remember them. Wasn't there something like, no country with a McDonald's?
With a McDonald's, yes. I was just going to bring that up.
Goes to war with each other. I mean, so there was a lot of talk that if you could just go in and, you know, put a McDonald's in these places, and then these problems that led to this terrorist attack would be ameliorated and fixed.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that one thing that really sticks out to me about this is how this moment has to be particularly unnerving for the generation of Americans who were, you know, essentially children or teenagers at the time of 9/11, you know, a generation that includes a lot of people who ultimately ended up serving in Afghanistan in this war, and who saw the arguments made for it transition over time. My brother is one of those young Americans. He is someone who has been over there multiple times and in his service with the Army. And he's jaded about Afghanistan is putting it lightly, which is to say he just sort of saw it as just sending good money after bad. It inspired a lot of frustration with the brass of the military, I think, that is shared by a lot of people in his generation. At what point did it become clear, to you at least, that the United States had really bitten off more than it could chew when it came to what these leaders were promising versus what they could deliver on potentially?
Well, first of all, we didn't get bin Laden. There was a period in the early Afghan war, and I mean in the first 6 months, I should go back over the timeline, in which bin Laden was thought to be cornered at a place called Tora Bora, and we didn't get him. And I think the failure to get bin Laden, which went on for 10 years, was a serious indication of a problem there. Then the misadventure in Iraq, which a lot of conservatives supported, later changed their mind on. I certainly did not oppose it. Mm-hmm. I was troubled by the idea, but I did not oppose the invasion of Iraq.
For what it's worth, just to put a note in it, I was opposed to it, but for the wrong reasons. So I don't really feel like I should get any credit for it. I was opposed to it because I thought it would lead to, I thought he did have WMDs and that he would use them against Israel and against a bunch, like it would throw off a ton of violence in the region that I didn't think was useful and unnecessary. So I feel like I shouldn't get any credit for it.
I think the both of us would agree now, a disastrous mistake.
Yes.
And it was twinned with Afghanistan kind of in the public mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these two wars, and one of them fully justified, the war in Afghanistan that went off on the wrong track, and the other one not justified, the war in Iraq. So I think people are beginning to see, certainly by 2004, 2005, that things have just gone terribly wrong. And yet there is this sense, you know, the commitment to Afghanistan kind of goes up and down. About 2,400 Americans have been killed in Afghanistan over the whole time. So, you know, in terms of historically of wars, it was a relatively low casualty conflict, which meant that it didn't really cause this kind of giant public uproar. You know, in the worst years of Vietnam, you had 500 Americans being killed in a week. Mm-hmm. And Afghanistan, it was 2,400 over the course of 20 years. So it almost kind of went off the radar at various times. And then I have to say, I would give Donald Trump credit for this. He really brings up the issue of open-ended war commitments during the 2016 campaign. Mm-hmm. And by this time, the U.S. government's discussions of Afghanistan had just turned into just total BS. What can I say? I'm gonna give you something from John Kerry, who was the Secretary of State in October 2016. They have a conference on Afghanistan in Brussels, and he comes out and he talks about what a success the war has been, and he says, quote, maternal mortality in childbirth in Afghanistan has gone down by 75%. Average life expectancy has risen from 42 to 62 years. Access to basic health care has skyrocketed from 9% to 67%. In 2001, there was only one television station, and it was owned by the government. Remember, I'm quoting John Kerry here. Now there are 75 television stations, and all but two are privately owned. Back then, there were virtually no cell phones, zero. Today, there are 18 million cell phones, covering about 90% of residential areas, connecting Afghans to the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the case for having gone to war in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, thank you, John Kerry, for helping so many Taliban finally be able to post their pictures to Facebook. I mean, really.
No, in the pictures we're seeing from Kabul now, I mean, they've all got a cell phone in their hand.
So. All the folks coming out of Bagram, they were all pulling out cell phones and making calls. I don't know if you saw that footage, but it really is a testament to how the way this was being sold completely changed. I'm Ben Domenech. We'll have more with Byron York right after this. Here I have to ask you about the media coverage aspect of this, because, you know, obviously Barack Obama ran against the Iraq war in terms of his frame of the issue in 2008. But he also ran on, you know, victory in Afghanistan and the idea that this was the good war. The one that he was prepared to do what it takes to find Osama bin Laden and to end the war there. But he ultimately didn't. And when Donald Trump runs in 2016, he runs on the idea of ending this supposedly endless commitment that in a way that seems to leave many in the media kind of flabbergasted, because I don't know whether it's that they don't believe the polls that are out there about the opinions of Americans, or whether they just don't care, but they just seem to be blindsided by the idea that this could have significant popular appeal. What do you think about the way that played out and the way that the media has covered the Afghanistan issue generally?
Well, in general, they're more critical when Republicans are in charge and less critical when Democrats are in charge. Mm-hmm. But nobody should be surprised at that. I agree that Trump brought this on and uncovered a Republican feeling that a lot of people, reporters, just didn't know was there. I remember very specifically, you probably remember the day, it was in February of 2016. There was a Republican debate, and we were in Greenville, South Carolina. It was the day that Antonin Scalia had died. Mm-hmm. So that just kind of took over the conversation that day. But during that debate, you know, Trump was standing next to Jeb Bush, and he loved to just, you know, heckle Bush all the time. And Trump said not only that had George Bush gone to war, a terrible mistake in Afghanistan, he had lied us into Afghanistan. It was a left-wing talking point. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, the Bush campaign was dying at that time. I remember going to a rally, like maybe it was the next day. George W. Bush comes to South Carolina, North Charleston, to try to revive the Jeb Bush campaign. And I talked to as many people as I could. And they didn't believe that Bush had lied. They trusted Bush more than that. But they also believed it was a terrible mistake. And that even if Bush was doing the best he could, it was a terrible mistake. So there was this reckoning that Republicans were engaged in with the fact that the war in Iraq, started by a Republican president they supported, had been a mistake. And so Trump not only didn't suffer from that, he actually benefited from just coming out and saying that. And Trump wanted to end all of the, quote, forever wars, but he didn't have the will or the skill or the judgment to do it. He wants to get out of Afghanistan in 2017 in his first year as president, and he's talked out of it. And then when as he's leaving out the door in 2020 to 2021, he wants to get out of Afghanistan again, and he's talked out of it. Mm. So he doesn't just issue the order, I'm the commander in chief, damn it, and we're out of there by Tuesday. He doesn't do that. And so now we're in this weird situation in which a lot of Biden supporters are saying that Biden has been kind of boxed in by what Trump had done on Afghanistan. And if I don't know if you saw it today, there was an excellent Wall Street Journal editorial about this.
Yes.
In which Biden basically has been blaming Trump for having tied his hands on Afghanistan, is having set up this deal, and then Biden really had no choice but to abide by the deal. And the journal points out that starting with inauguration day, Joe Biden has been discarding one Trump policy after another in foreign policy and domestic policy. And yet this one is the Afghanistan deal, is the one that he claims that his hands were tied on. They weren't. He could have done whatever he wanted. He could have thrown any Trump commitments out the window, just as he threw, say, for example, the migrant protection protocols, the remain in Mexico policy, completely out the window on day one. So
I wonder if, just in your initial observation, it seems to me that so often the media's motivations when they are talking about issues of foreign policy, they invest an enormous amount of authority in those figures, particularly former government figures, with whom they agree ideologically. They look the other way on all of their mistakes and faults, of course, you know, otherwise John Brennan would never be on TV. But they also have this attitude that is kind of like, I'll simplify it to say, don't make me look like an idiot for treating you this way. In other words, on story after story, you can kind of sense when something goes sideways, and the thing that the politician was kept promising, or the former government official kept promising, was the case, turns out not to be true. The attitude of the media shifts and basically is angry at them, not because they lied or because they didn't tell the truth about what was going on in the first place, but because they made them look like idiots, in other words, for accepting the story. This seems to be a recurring phenomenon, and it seems to me to be happening again with Afghanistan right now, in part because so many of these commentators and people were kind of going out there and saying, well, you know, the Biden team they're the professionals. They're the return to normalcy. They're the people who can be trusted, unlike these fly-by-night, shoot-from-the-hip Trumpsters. You know, they're the ones who can manage our foreign policy better and position America in a way that says America is back. I think, you know, of all the CNN commentators, for instance, saying things along those lines. And right now, those people have to sort of feel like they're being made to look like idiots. And that, to me, is just an indication of how broken our media is. Because that shouldn't be the priority.
this is what you might call the adult in the room problem. Because they sold Biden as the president who would be the adult in the room. Now, what's happened? And he's just mangled this terribly. I mean, it is hard to overstate how badly he has mismanaged this. Now, it's hard for people like us to find exactly the right tone about this, because I favored withdrawing from Afghanistan. And the article that you quoted from at the beginning of this interview was in favor of getting out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And yet Biden has found a way to do it that seems to be just the worst of all possibilities. And that he could have gotten out of Afghanistan in a much more orderly and professional way. Mm-hmm. And yet we're seeing these crazy, you know, it is 2021 version of Saigon now with the C-17 rolling down the runway. Yeah. And just hundreds and hundreds of people running along with it, trying to, you know, get a handhold in the wheel well. And it's just hideous pictures.
Absolutely, absolutely devastating. And I think a very basic question that I have and that I'd like to hear Congress ask about this is, given the anticipated result of the Americans and our allies exiting on a schedule, why was there not greater steps taken to accelerate the visa process for so many translators and those who worked along the United States and our allies, who are obvious targets in the wake of leaving and who are now, you know, resorting to begging people for help? There's a heartbreaking interview that I saw yesterday with a former service officer who was just moved to almost to tears, talking about the number of people reaching out to her who believe that they will die in very short order because they're not able to leave the country. Something like that should have been anticipated. I thought that was the whole reason that Biden kind of gave to delay the initial timeline. Is this just a monumental botched exit job on the part of the administration? What do you believe we're going to discover?
I think the answer is yes.
All of the above.
You certainly make the argument that there's going to be no easy way out of this. Mm. And perhaps no really clean way out of this in which nobody gets hurt. But it does seem that the administration could have pursued this in a more systematic way. The first priority being to get the human beings that need to get out of Afghanistan, getting them out in as great a numbers as possible before this. The second being protect or destroy the material assets that are left there, the weapons and equipment that will now become Taliban weapons and equipment, and then getting the final force, the U.S. military force that was required to do the previous two things, getting them out. It'll be interesting to hear the inside accounts of why this was not done, why the Biden administration did not pursue this. I know that military people, listening to General Keane on Fox today, military people are appalled that it was handled in this way, because the president could have ordered it done however he felt was best. Mm-hmm. His hands were not tied. He was not locked into a certain policy. It was his policy to make. And so why he chose this is, I have to say, a mystery to me. And as we speak, the president has not made any sort of public comments for several days.
That's the thing that I was going to ask you about next.
Yeah.
I was corresponding. I don't think I'm breaking any violation of a private conversation by sharing this, but I was corresponding with Morgan Ortegas, our colleague on Fox, who obviously is a veteran of the Trump administration, worked for Mike Pompeo, and has been around defense policy for a long time. And she said that in all of her years of working in defense policy, of working in any way to along these lines, she has never seen anything like this in terms of the silence from the administration. The away message that you get when you email Jen Psaki, the lack of comment from senior people, and to me, I mean, I agree with you that I think that there's so many ways that this could have gone badly, and I anticipated, this was going to be bad, not this bad. But the disappearing act being done by the president in this is something I never would have anticipated. It's almost as if he's back in the bunker during the 2020 campaign. It just doesn't make any sense
to make it worse. to make it worse, the White House released one photo on Sunday, and it's the president in the Situation Room at Camp David by himself around an enormous conference table, looking up at a screen where he's conducting a teleconference meeting with aides. And it looked so weird and so isolated and so out of touch and so not in charge that you wonder, just from an optic sense, what in the world are they doing? Mm-hmm. The bigger problem, of course, is the substance. And the president needs to explain. This is one of these times where the president needs to tell the American people why he's doing what he's doing. And I would listen. I mean, if he has a good case to make, I want to hear it. But he hasn't so far.
I mean, and the case that I would assume, the strongest case that I would assume that he could make is basically someone eventually had to bite the bullet and I decided it had to be me. And that would be, you know, something that I think, you know, a lot of Americans, even if they disagreed with it, would at least understand.
Right.
Though it would be an admission on some level that his happy talk of the past couple of weeks was baseless or was exaggerated. The other aspect of this that I think is really incumbent upon him to explain to us is why we should have any faith in the military brass or the intel community that promised that what basically happened in the course of 72 hours was going to take 3 months.
When the president came out and said that we were not going to have any sort of scene like Saigon, that the Afghan military was a strong and well-equipped force, there was no way they were going to just fold in a week or two. I don't think he was just making that up.
Yeah.
I think that he was using information that he had been given by his team, his national security team, in the various briefings he's been holding. So here again, it's horrible how many stories involve the intelligence community. Yeah. Because so often they involve a level of secrecy that is just almost criminal, that the American people should be able to know, you know, what intelligence assessments were and how they were used in big decisions like this. Mm-hmm. So we do need to know. And here again, I am totally open to the idea of the intelligence community messing this up. And Biden, to some degree, relying on bad intelligence. Mm-hmm. I just want to hear it from the president.
Yeah, like, and I think that this is something that, you know, Americans. I was standing out in front of our old address, and a woman came by who stopped and said hi to me and said that her son was working at the Pentagon and her other son had done multiple tours in Afghanistan and was, she's a Gold Star mom, you know, he's buried in Arlington. And she was just furious and distraught about the fact that the president wasn't saying anything. And just, you know, she was saying, where is he? Where is he? And I said, well, he's at Camp David, but you know, when it comes to the people who have sacrificed so much and the families that have given so much, you know, they certainly deserve, and the American people deserve, and Congress deserves an explanation for this. And it just boggles my mind that they think they can just kick the can on it or keep their head down and get past it. And my question for you is, do you think that this will have any kind of long-term ramifications for the relationship between this White House and the press? Because to me, this is one of the first things they've done that is just unavoidably, you know, we can talk about breaking norms on things like the eviction moratorium or all these other ways that he's already been breaking norms. But the press gets infuriated when they're breaking a norm that matters to them, you know? And so do you think that this will have any ramifications on that score?
The biggest issue is the substantial issue, which is the American people. Mm-hmm. And the president owes them an explanation for what he's done. Certainly for the military families, Representative Dan Crenshaw was actually getting a respectful interview on MSNBC a few minutes before we're talking now. And he of course, was seriously wounded in Afghanistan. And he was making the argument to his fellow service members that their service had not been in vain for these 20 years. And it was good to hear Crenshaw say that, but the president needs to say it too.
Yeah. Let's go out on this because it's something that I think is a recurring problem that we have in America. We have these institutions that surround us that have crumbled in terms of the authority and trust that they receive from the American people. I know that you're very familiar with the Gallup. It's just decline, decline, decline. And it's everything. You know, it's not just government and Congress and the media. It's the church. It's organized sports. It's everything. And the two things that have really been resistant to that over the years has been small businesses, because there's so many small business owners in America, and the American military. And to me, this really does feel like an American military defeat in a humiliating way that will become identified as, you know, a signature moment under the Biden administration that I just can't think of a way that he's going to come back from. Is there something that I'm missing, or do you think that that's the case?
Well, first of all, I think you're right about attitudes toward the military. And this will be viewed as a failure of the commander in chief.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and, you know, obviously people become incredibly angry at even the possible thought that so much sacrifice was in vain. They want to believe, they have to believe that the leadership was absolutely sincere in pursuing goals to protect the United States of America. So this will be viewed as a failure of the commander in chief. And I do think that one huge problem going forward is how other nations view this. They will see Biden as weak, and as perhaps out of touch. And will that cause them to be more adventurous, more challenging to the United States? I don't know. But the pictures that we're seeing from the airport in Kabul really are historic level pictures that go along with those from Saigon in 1975. And those did enormous damage to American credibility. Not permanent, but they did a lot of lasting damage to the American policymakers who had whose actions led to that. So I think you're right. Biden suffers permanent damage from this.
Byron York, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Ben. Enjoyed it.
So in terms of looking at Afghanistan, I have some initial thoughts that are pretty scattered. But one of the things that I think we have to agree upon in this instance is that after 20 years of fractiousness, we finally found unity on one thing politically about Afghanistan, and that's that this is a disaster. The situation in Kabul seems hellish. People are literally falling out of the wheel wells of C-130s, desperate to get out of the country. The idea that a delay from the original timeline for departure set by President Trump would enable the U.S. and our allies to prepare looks ludicrous in hindsight. Instead, moving the exit into the fighting season and allowing the Taliban more time to prepare. And to me, one of the really stunning aspects of this is the absence of the president. It's so bizarre to have an event of this historic nature not result in any kind of presidential address or even public comment about what's going on, especially with all his team apparently on vacation as well. It's like they just decided to take things off. There is no hand at the wheel, it feels like. In a responsible military situation, the people who were in charge of managing this exit would all be out. There's a level of mismanagement that's gone on here that is absolutely embarrassing for the American military and for our leading officials. The White House obviously is going to get the brunt of this, but there's plenty of blame to go around. The insulation from consequences for these military leaders is absolutely absurd. It's something that I've talked about repeatedly, particularly when it comes to General Mark Milley and to the other people who've come out of CENTCOM, the current Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and the like. Whatever happened to resigning because of your own failure? nowadays, it seems like people are only expected to resign and protest for other people's mistakes, but never for their own. I feel like it's almost time that we treated generals the way that we treat closing down military bases or something like that, where there's a group of people who make the decision independent of the general themselves. Whoever Joe Biden doesn't fire after this, that means that he believes their performance in this instance was acceptable. And if this is acceptable, how can the American people possibly trust the NSA, the CIA, or the Pentagon again? I mean, it's in if their most recent predictions were so completely off, so utterly divorced from reality, how can we trust this intel expert class to, you know, do their jobs and not to fail us again? They predicted this would take months and that the Afghan army would fight. And now they've revised their predictions on terrorist formation, according to Mark Milley. And they're saying, you know, oh, yes, there were definitely some other voices in the room that didn't think this was going to go the way that, you know, the press was reporting. Well, that's all well and good. But the commander in chief came in front of the American people and he worked off of your initial reports. And those initial reports have nothing to do with what just happened. Why should we believe anything that they say now or going forward? I also wonder if the president himself believed what he was saying. You can go back over the speeches of the past 2 years, you know, look at all the promises that he made about it, his denial of responsibility, his assurance the Afghans would fight, et cetera. Part of the issue here is that Biden is unwilling to engage in the trade-off conversation the way that Trump did. He wanted to argue that this whole thing would go well when it was clear to anyone with a brain that it wouldn't. That, to me, is a big part of the questions going forward. Joe Biden ran on the idea that he was going to restore American purpose around the world, the trust that was placed in the nation, the authority that we had prior potentially to President Donald Trump. Instead, he seems to have squandered all of it in very short order. And I always thought that that argument was ridiculous and a lie. I don't believe that President Trump actually, you know, in any way conveyed a level of distrust with the American project among our allies. He actually had good relationships with a lot of our allies, particularly ones in Asia, such as India. But this is a situation where I think Joe Biden was sold to the American people as being something he fundamentally was not. A steady hand, an adult in the room, someone who would bring back normalcy and bring back respect for America. None of this has turned out to be true. I'm Ben Domenech. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case, available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.